About this subject, I mean, it's slightly embarrassing because there are many people in the audience who have both pioneered a lot of the ideas I'll be talking about and are doing the most exciting work developing them. So you could also get a colloquium from local people on many aspects of this subject, both the faculty members like Freddie and Pedro, as well as some of the postdocs, Dave Skinner and Amit Sever, just doing spectacular work over the past several years. But I'm visiting, so and there was an open slot, so I'm very happy to give a colloquium on this subject. This is it's a very rich and very deep subject that's also moving very quickly. In a sense, it's a very bad time to be giving a colloquium about it. You know, one should normally give, and normally one gives colloquia about subjects which are sufficiently well understood that you can summarize what's going on in a pithy phrase or two. And that's not what's going on here. We're still, I think, deep in the middle of what feels to many of us like a real revolution in our understanding of quantum field theory. But we're not done. We don't know what the one-sentence summary is. Nonetheless, I think there's enough things that have been established now that's clear there's a real structure here. And so I will take a risk of talking about it, despite the fact that, as I said, it's very, very much a work in progress. Also, perhaps unusually, I won't be giving references to who did what when throughout this talk. This is very unlikely to be an hour talk as it is, and if I do that, it would take even longer. Suffice to say that the history of the subject is fascinating and dramatic and has lots of incredible twists and turns, and it's also not over yet. So I won't be sort of footnoting who did what everywhere. Instead of doing that, let me just say this is the entire group of people in the world who's working on this subject, more or less. One thing, so you'll notice it's not a very big group of people, but we are working very hard. And it is interesting that it draws on people from very, very diverse backgrounds, ranging from twister theory here on the right, to people doing hardcore calculations for actually calculating scattering amplitudes at colliders, to string theorists, to people who specialize in understanding the physics of integrable systems in two dimensions, and even some mathematicians. And the part of the excitement here is that there is something going on which is drawing together inexorably these very, very disparate parts of the field. Okay, so what we're talking about is the scattering amplitudes in gauge theories. There's also remarkable things happening in gravity, but we'll have our hands full just talking about gauge theories. And I want to start with why we might be interested in these questions. Of course, scattering amplitudes are the bread and butter of particle physics. That's what people compute. Thinking about that's what's computed for making predictions at accelerators. And also thinking about scattering amplitudes was one of the driving forces behind the development of quantum field theory, especially the more modern understanding of quantum field theory that was associated with Feynman. We don't need to motivate talking about scattering amplitudes beyond that, but I want to spend a few minutes talking about what I think are some even deeper motivations for thinking about this subject. And I'm going to spend a few minutes talking about something that, on the face of it, has nothing to do with the question of something as mundane seeming as the scattering amplitudes of gluons in gauge theories. That has to do with the sort of deepest problem, the deepest aspect of the problem of putting gravity and quantum mechanics together. And here, at least, we have slogans. And one of the slogans is that putting gravity and quantum mechanics together means that space-time is doomed. Space-time doesn't make sense as a fundamental notion. It has got to be replaced by something else. There's lots of thought experiments. Presumably, many of you have seen thought experiments of this sort. If you imagine trying to resolve what's going on at a small region of space using a magnifying glass, you have to put so much energy into such a small region of space that at some point you can't neglect its gravitational back reaction, and you collapse the little region that you're looking at into a black hole. That happens at distances of order the Planck length. And if you try even harder to probe even shorter distances, you just make a bigger black hole. So there's no operational way of probing distances and times that are much shorter than the Planck length. And so every time that's happened to us in physics before, where there's no operational way of attaching meaning to something, it means that the thing that we're talking about isn't really fundamental. It's an emergent phenomenon from something else, an approximate description of something else. But here it's very startling because the thing that we're getting rid of is space-time. And physics, if nothing else, is about the description normally of what happens to processes in space as they evolve in time. So ordinarily, we think that these issues become important near the Planck length, when curvatures become very high near the Big Bang or close to black hole singularities. And there's no denying that our theories simply break down there. But there's really a deeper sense. There's something actually deeper about about the fact that space-time is doomed. It isn't just that things stop making sense at short distances. That's not even a very Lorentz invariant statement. It's a more subtle fact. And the more subtle fact has to do with the fact that in a precise sense, the inside of the space-time doesn't exist at all. It's not like there is some, it's not a smooth that's replaced by some discrete structure or something like that. It's something much more surprising and interesting than that naive picture. And to see that, let's go back and think about one of the basic features of quantum mechanics. When we teach quantum mechanics, we pat our students on the head and we tell them it's not so bad that things are probabilistic. At least you can measure the probabilities or predict the probabilities precisely. But that involves two infinities. That involves, first of all, doing the experiment infinitely often so you can get sharp predictions from a statistical theory. It also involves doing the experiment with an infinitely large measuring apparatus. You have to make that measuring apparatus infinitely large to have perfect decoherence between the system that you're measuring and the apparatus. The only way to extract sharp predictions from quantum mechanics posits the existence of an infinitely large apparatus and experiments that happen infinitely often. And what happens is that gravity makes one or both of these things impossible. The thing that it always makes impossible is the fact that you can make the measuring device arbitrarily big, at least if you want to do local measurements. Imagine I want to do any measurement, like in this room, any measurement at all. So I put an apparatus in this room. I study some system in this room. But to achieve perfect decoherence, I make the apparatus bigger and bigger. It has to have more and more degrees of freedom. It inevitably has more and more mass. And before I get to make it infinitely big, it collapses the entire room into a black hole. So before we talk about theories, before we talk about formalisms, before we talk about any of these theoretical things, there is a question. What should a theory compute? What should the output be? What's in principle observable? And this tells you there is nothing that's local, that's a local measurement, that's even in principle observable. It's a very startling fact. Of course, this is the slogan many of you have heard. There are no local observables in gravity. And when I tell this to experimental colleagues, they ask me what the heck they're doing in their labs all day. And the answer is they're making measurements of things that there's no experiment they could possibly design that would reduce the systematic error in what they're measuring to zero. What they're computing are not exact things. They're not, what they're measuring are not the limits of things that can be in principle made exact. They're just fundamentally approximate. Okay, so that's fine for all practical purposes, but it's a very deep clue about the nature of the fundamental theory that there are simply no local questions that have well-defined answers. What kinds of questions do have well-defined answers? Well, what you can do is make the apparatus infinitely big, provided you separate the apparatuses from each other infinitely. So the kinds of observables that do make sense are associated with the boundaries of the space-time. So you might imagine throwing in some particles from infinity. They bang into each other in the middle. They go back out to infinity. And you can measure everything about them with apparatuses that you make bigger and bigger and bigger, because you can do that, separating them further and further apart from the rest of what is going on. So this is a very basic argument. It sounds very similar to the ideas of holography, that the observables live at the boundary. In fact, this precise statement, which is a very precise statement, was already known to people who thought deeply about quantum gravity in the 1960s, that the only observable in the theory of quantum gravity lives on the boundary. So that's very disturbing. But at least in some spacetimes, it's very strange, but at least in some spacetimes, there's something sensible. For example, in flat space, there's a well-defined notion of a boundary, and this observable is nothing other than what it looks like, is the S matrix. So a great thing, as many of you know, a spectacular thing that happened 13 years ago is a very concrete realization of this idea in the context of the ADS-CFT correspondence, where we're not talking about flat space, but we're talking about a space with a uniform negative curvature, anti-de Sitter space. The geometry is like the inside of this tin can. And exactly the same argument would tell you that the only observables are associated with the boundary. You ping things at the boundary, and you measure correlations between what happens when you ping things here and there and what comes out at the boundary at some time later. So exactly this general argument would tell you those are the only observables. You might think you can only compute them by evolving through what happens in the inside of the anti-de Sitter space and coming back out. But the incredible thing is that there's a direct way of doing the same computation that never makes any reference to the inside of the space at all and simply talks about the conformal field theory that lives on the boundary. So I think this is certainly the most exciting thing I've ever seen in theoretical physics in my lifetime. And it tells us many, many things, things that we thought were different parts of the field, string theory and particle physics, they're the same thing. There isn't many different parts of the subject. There's one gigantic structure. And in various limits, it can look like things that we previously had names for, string theory, particle physics, but they're really exactly the same thing. Now, ADS-CFT is the gateway drug to this idea that the inside of the space-time doesn't exist. Okay? It's the gateway drug because it allows you to start thinking about this physics without giving everything up. Okay? In particular, the boundary here is a totally normal 3+1 dimensional flat space, and in particular, it has a time. Okay, so the dual theory that we're talking about is just a good old-fashioned 3+1 dimensional quantum field theory. The time that flows in on the outside is the same as the time that flows in the middle of the bulk. So it's stunning that all these things emerge. Gravity emerges, extra dimensions emerge, all these incredible strings emerge. All of that stuff emerges, but we're not forced to completely change our language to describe what the more fundamental description is. It's just an ordinary quantum mechanical theory. In fact, an ordinary quantum field theory just happens to be in the limit of strong coupling. The difficulty is that, and I think this to me is, it solves an incredible number of problems. Essentially, every short distance aspect of quantum gravity is, in my view, a solved problem. Okay? Because any short distance question about quantum gravity is the same in anti-de Sitter space as it is in any other space-time. And so, given that you wouldn't expect the local question to care whether the curvature is negative 10 to the 10 light years or positive 10 to the 10 light years, you're going to get the same answer for any local question. So all the standard short distance mysteries about quantum gravity are just, I think, essentially gone. But what remains are infrared large distance questions that are still mysterious. The most mysterious ones of those are in cosmology. And they're mysterious because there's no obvious boundary where anything can live. There aren't even any obvious observables. If we talk about the accelerating universe, our accelerating universe, again, before talking about formalism, before talking about how you would go about defining, they just ask, are there any observables at all? And there aren't obviously any. Okay? And the difficulty is that we're surrounded by this cosmological horizon. We can't see what's going on outside. We can't make infinitely large apparatuses. We can't do the experiment infinitely often. There simply is no standard quantum mechanical observables we can even talk about. Okay? So I think this is the very hardest problem that we have to face. And it's completely clear that to understand it, we have to figure out not just where space comes from, but where time comes from as well. That's the central new thing in the context of cosmology. But this is a very hard problem. If you look at any of the summary talks by grand poobahs in the last 10 or 15 years, they'll talk about needing to understand the emergence of space-time. And you can say that until you turn blue, but it doesn't tell you what to do next. Okay? It's very important to know what the big problems are, but it's very important to know how to make progress on them and to find problems that you can make progress on that are perhaps related to the problems that you eventually want to get to. And so while understanding the physics of de Sitter space seems very hard problem that's not likely to be solved soon, Many of these same issues arise already in trying to understand the physics of scattering in flat space. So that's one motivation, trying to understand scattering in flat space without putting in the inside of the spacetime, simply because we know the inside of the spacetime isn't really there. Now, let me give you an analogy for this investigation. Of course, it's happened to us before in physics that seemingly hardwired concepts we had to lose. Most dramatically, in going from classical to quantum mechanics, we had to lose the idea of determinism. If you imagine some ghost of theorist future coming to some classical physicist in the year 1820 and saying, I have news from the 1930s, determinism is gone. And then they disappear off into the night, as ghosts of theorist future normally do. What would you do with that information if you're an 1830s classical physicist? It's like having the rug completely pulled out from under your feet. How can it be? Determinism is hardwired into everything. It works. How can it possibly be that nature isn't deterministic? And you might fret that it's beyond, you know, the ability of poor human beings to figure out. But there's always a way. There's always a way because physics is self-consistent. And so if you learn that determinism is eventually gone, you don't have to wait around and wait for someone to either give you thousands of experimental clues or to tell you the right answer. You can do something all by yourself. You can say, look, if determinism is gone, but our current laws work so well, that must mean that our current laws are the deformation or the degeneration of some new theory. So there's some new theory. In some limit, it will reduce to ours. But whatever that new theory is cannot have determinism hardwired into it. So it's very unlikely that its limit where it turns to our theory is also going to have the notion of determinism in it. That means that there must be some way of talking about our present theory, not the new theory. There must be some way of talking about the theory we have now, which doesn't make determinism manifest. Okay? There is such a way of talking about classical mechanics. It's the principle of least action. Okay? And when you first learn it in school, it looks rather odd that the particle goes from A to B, seemingly sniffing out every possible way, and picking the one that minimizes the action. It's not manifestly deterministic. It is, in its consequences, deterministic. It's identical to Newton's laws, but it's a way of talking about Newton's laws that doesn't put in the concept that's eventually lost in quantum mechanics. And in fact, we now understand why the second formulation exists. It morally exists because the world isn't classical, it's quantum mechanical. And the h-bar goes to zero limit of the true quantum theory isn't Newton's laws. It couldn't have been Newton's laws. You can't get determinism out of nowhere. But it could be the least action principle, which is a way of talking about classical physics that doesn't have this concept hardwired in it that you have to lose. So this is always a way that we have to proceed. If there's some concept that we think, and now in the present context, that concept is the inside of the spacetime or spacetime locality. If we suspect that for some reason that concept is suspect and we have to lose it, one thing we can do is learn how to eviscerate that concept entirely from standard physics and learn to talk about standard physics without putting it in. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to try to think about the physics of scattering amplitudes in a way that that doesn't put the inside of the space-time in. And we'll see a lot more besides. So, so I just went through that discussion. All right, so that's the highfalutin motivation. So let me talk about the much more concrete motivation. And the much more concrete motivation simply has to do with the fact that when you actually sit down to compute these scattering amplitudes, it's a major pain in the ass. You had a colloquium last week by Michael Peskin, who talked about many of these things, so I'll go through this part a little more quickly. But it is amusing that people were motivated to do these calculations for very bread-and-butter reasons of figuring out backgrounds at hadron colliders, where unlike Feynman, who could get famous by computing 2-to-2 scattering processes, you really need 2-to-3, 2-to-4 higher scattering processes. And you sit down and you do it, and it's a nightmare. For the scattering of 6 gluons, 2-to-4 gluons, for example, it's a process that takes place hundreds of thousands of times a second at the LHC, one of the dominant backgrounds for discovering supersymmetry. Just at tree level, there's 220 diagrams, I don't know, tens of thousands of terms, and it's a complete disaster until Park and Taylor discovered in the 1980s that at least for certain helicity configurations for the gluons, the answer collapsed to a single line, single term. Okay? And in fact, if you have the scattering amplitude for two gluons of negative helicity and the rest of them positive helicity, it's just this, that simple one-term expression. Okay. So that was already an indication there's something very, very wrong about the way Feynman tells you to do the calculation. So what's wrong? I mean, is this just some accidental problem? Is it a trick? What's actually wrong? There's something deep going on here. Okay? So what is it that makes Feynman diagrams so complicated? What is it that makes them obscure the simplicity of the answer? And as we'll see, more than the simplicity and this enormous structure that we're going to be talking about in the rest of the talk. The answer is very directly. I mean, it's not indirectly related to this. It is absolutely directly the insistence on manifest locality and unitarity, the very two things that are the cornerstones of the standard way of talking about quantum field theory. Okay? That's what quantum field theory is. It's a way of talking about quantum mechanics that makes Lorentz invariance and locality manifest. Those are the rules. You follow them. Dirac and Born and Heisenberg tell you the basic rules. Feynman and Schwinger and friends tell you how to make them practical. But it's exactly those rules and those foundations that lead to this enormous complexity. And actually, the reason begins not for simple things like phi to the fourth theory. Phi to the fourth theory really is crummy. The scattering amplitudes really are just junky. There's nothing nice about them. They're as complicated as you expect from Feynman diagrams. But something magic starts happening for spin one, even more magic for spin two, but we won't have time to talk about it today. So it's a very basic reason. Let's say you want to describe a photon moving along in some direction. As you know, the photon just has helicity. So it has spin either in a direction of motion or opposite to its direction of motion. So there's 2 degrees of freedom associated with the photon because it's massless. Now, locality tells us that if we want to describe the interactions of photons in a local way, we need to assemble all the photons into a field. Because it's spin one, it has to have a vector index. So it's some a nu of x. If I want to describe that photon, I write a polarization vector and a plane wave e to the ipx. But immediately we have the problem that there's 4 components here, 0, 1, 2, 3, and there's 2 degrees of freedom for the photon. So immediately, our insistence on describing things in a local way forces us to propagate extra unphysical degrees of freedom around. You see that very, very vividly if you just try to dumbly restrict the number of degrees of freedom. Say, okay, no, that's fine. It's not the most general epsilon. Let's say I put some constraint on it. I say epsilon dot p is equal to 0. That's fine. That reduces you down to 3 degrees of freedom. But that's it. You're stuck. There's absolutely nothing you can do to not have 3 degrees of freedom floating around in a Lorentz invariant way. And as you see, one of the difficulties is that because p squared is equal to 0, because the photon is massless, if you have epsilon, you can add anything proportional to p mu to epsilon, and it will satisfy that constraint. Okay? So there's some extra, that's the 3rd degree of freedom. I can't uniquely specify a polarization vector. I can only specify them by something proportional to the momentum. That's why the only thing you can do if you want to insist on manifest locality and unitarity went in telling you that the unitary representations of the Lorentz group are labeled by helicity. Locality goes in to describing things with a field. If you want to hold those principles manifest, you must do the following. You must say that you identify. You carry all these things around, and then you identify. You say epsilon and epsilon plus alpha p are to be identified as the same state. Okay? So we necessarily have some redundancy in our description of the physics. Back in position space, that's nothing other than gauge transformations. Okay? And what's, as a misnomer, called gauge symmetries, whose beauty is extolled at length in older textbooks on the subject, is a completely garbage. It's content-free. There's nothing to it. Gauge symmetry is in our head. It's in our attempt to describe physics to make these principles manifest. Okay. Gauge symmetry is a fake. Diffeomorphisms are an even bigger fake. Okay? These are all in our head. It's a part of the formalism, not a part of the physics. And it's part of the formalism to make locality and unitarity manifest. And this is a source of all the trouble, because you have all these unphysical, degrees of freedom flying around throughout the diagrams, and they only cancel out collectively in the sum. You can't even say that cancels that, cancels that. You need to go through these tens of thousands of terms. They all collapse into a simple formula. Gauge symmetry is at the root of the evil. Okay. So all of these things have been understood for 60 years. What has not been understood for 60 years is that there's a better way, and that there's another way, and the other way is better. And I want to stress this because if you don't follow too much of the technical details in the rest of the talk, this is the message I want you to get. That what we're talking about here is not speculative. It is a property of standard, good old-fashioned, four-dimensional theories that have been understood, written down 60 years ago. We'll be talking about a supersymmetric version of them because it makes our life easier in the beginning. It's like talking about the harmonic oscillator first before you talk about solids, okay? But it's not fancy new things. It's not speculative extensions of physics. It's good old-fashioned physics that we've known about for 60 years has inside it, if only people bothered to look, and people bothered to look by doing computations, okay? Has inside it some incredible structure that's telling you that probably, though, that there's a better way of thinking about things that doesn't put those principles in. And amazingly, this, as I mentioned at the start, seems to combine ideas from string theory and ADS-CFT, twister theory, integrable systems, as well as a host of new structures, new mathematical structures in algebraic geometry, all very surprisingly combining in something. Something there that's telling us how to think about scattering without putting in space-time and without putting in unitarity. All right, so that's what I want to tell you about in the rest of the talk. Is there a clock somewhere? There isn't a clock. Oh, okay, great. You can blame him. Thank you, you'll get your $20 later. All right. Okay, great, thank you. All right, so I want to now spend a little bit of time telling you about the cast of characters. Okay. So we're talking about gluon scattering amplitudes. So imagine we have gluons, which we'll represent in some double line notation as carrying a color and an anti-color index. And we'll also be talking about, so they might scatter with each other at tree level. Here I'm imagining drawing some Feynman diagrams, some tree-level Feynman diagrams. Here we have loop-level Feynman diagrams. And as Atof taught us in the early 70s, if we imagine taking the limit where the number of colors goes to infinity, the diagrams that dominate are all the ones that you can draw on a plane, or all the planar diagrams. So that's what we'll first be focusing on. This is, should be the simplest limit of any theory, of any gauge theory, is the planar limit. Okay, so at tree level, as we'll discuss in a bit, the amplitudes are nice, simple, rational functions of the external kinematic variables. And let me just immediately tell you the object we're going to be talking about at loop level, because famously, loop amplitudes for massless particles, the final answer suffers from infrared divergences, and you have to think about how to interpret it physically and so on. But something very nice happens in the planar limit, a very, very simple but important point. Is that there is a well-defined notion of the integrand of the scattering amplitude before you do the integral over loop momenta. Okay. Well, you might naively think the integrand always exists. Just take all the Feynman diagrams, put them all under one big integral sign. But you can do that if you want, but it's meaningless, because what you mean by the loop momentum L in this diagram and that diagram and that diagram have nothing whatsoever to do with each other. And you can shift them by a constant. In one diagram relative to the other, relative to the other. It turns out a very simple argument, I won't go through it in detail, tells you that does not happen for planar theories, and there is a well-defined way to gather them all up together and put them under one integral sign. So that's what we're going to be talking about. And we'll push to the end the issue of actually carrying out the integrations. But this is a well-defined object that we should learn to compute. Okay, we'll also be imagining that all the momenta are incoming. So that's a very symmetrical way of talking about things. There's no in and out. We just have momenta which have some of the energies are positive, some of the energies are negative. So this is the sort of thing that we're going to be talking about. So the amplitude is a function of the momenta, the helicities of the gluons, plus or minus one, and the various loop momentum variables. A little bit more kinematics that I think you saw last week, so I will recap quickly. Since we're dealing with massless particles, we normally assemble them into a four vector. But when we do this, again, there's some extra redundant baggage. There's a P0 and a P, but really the magnitude of P0 is forced to equal the magnitude of P. So there's a nicer way of packaging this information in a 2x2 matrix that you get just by dotting these p's into the Pauli matrices. And you'll notice if you look at this matrix, its determinant is nothing other than the dot product of p with itself. Now, if you have a massless particle, p squared is zero, that means this 2x2 matrix has zero determinant. And it's a 2x2 matrix with zero determinant, so it has rank one. So I can write it as the outer product of a vector and another vector in general. Okay. So that's a nicer way of talking about massless particles. I just have to specify two of these little spinners, lambda and lambda tilde. Lorentz transformations act as SL2, just the linear transformations of unit determinant on this lambda, and a separate SL2 that acts on that one. And you can therefore build invariance just out of contracting these guys with an epsilon symbol and these guys also with an epsilon symbol. Okay? These variables are not a trick. There's physics that goes into describing amplitudes in this way. And that is that amplitudes have to have a property that if you think of them as functions of the momentum of the external particles, if you do a Lorentz transformation, they're not invariant, but they have to pick up a rotation by the corresponding action of the little group on each one of the external particles. Okay? That's another way of saying what the difficulty with Feynman diagrams is. Feynman diagrams don't compute an object that looks like that. They compute what would be a Lorentz tensor. That's what you compute in the textbook. So it's something that has, if you have n particles, it has indices mu 1 up to mu n. But that's not what the physical amplitude is. The physical amplitude doesn't transform under Lorentz transformations. It transforms into the little group for the external particles. Okay? So, and that's why many of you have never seen an actual amplitude in any quantum field theory course. You stop at the level of computing what Feynman tells you to do, and then you dot them into polarization vectors, and then you never finish the process. Okay? It's very hard to finish the process in the standard formalism because of all the redundancy. But in fact, scattering amplitudes are directly a function of these spinner helicity variables in four dimensions. The general answer in any number of dimensions isn't known. It's a small travesty that it isn't known. It should be in chapter one of any quantum field theory textbook. It isn't. We don't know the answer to the simple math question, what are scattering amplitudes functions of in any number of dimensions in a non-redundant way? But happily, we know the answer in four dimensions. They're a function of these spinner helicity variables. And you actually just read off directly from that what that function is, exactly what the helicities of the particles involved are. Because there just has to be some simple homogeneities under rescaling lambda and lambda tilde. So you notice that since p is equal to lambda, lambda tilde, p is not uniquely, a given p doesn't uniquely specify lambda and lambda tilde. I can multiply lambda by something and divide lambda tilde by the same thing. That's exactly the action of the little group. So what you have to have then is that the amplitude has a particular homogeneity under rescaling any one of these variables is just given by its helicity. So if you look at this amplitude I wrote down a second ago, you can tell, even if I didn't tell you, that this is something that corresponds to these particles having negative helicity and the rest of them having positive helicity simply by seeing what happens under rescaling particle 2, for example. Okay. Finally, so far we're just talking about gluons that have helicity plus and minus 1. So there's something extremely annoying about the amplitudes in this theory. They have this horrible discrete index for every particle, plus 1 or minus 1. Okay? And it's always a pain to have discrete things lying around. So there's a simpler theory that we could talk about, simpler purely from the point of view of the kinematics of the amplitudes, simpler for other reasons as we'll see. But the very simplest theory we could be talking about is not just the pure gluon theory, but the maximally supersymmetric version of it. And it's really the maximal supersymmetry that matters here. It's not just some SUSY. It's really the maximal SUSY that makes life incredibly simple, because the maximal supersymmetry allows you to rotate from a negative helicity gluon to a positive helicity gluon to put them all in one gigantic supermultiplet. Okay? And in fact, instead of talking about individual helicity states, we should talk about things that diagonalize the action of the supersymmetry, so they're like Grassmann coherent states that are labeled by Grassmann parameters. I'm calling eta tilde here. And this is nothing other than a particular linear combination of all of these different particular helicity states on which supersymmetry acts nicely. But it's a smooth Grassmann parameter, not a discrete helicity label. So, and finally, so this is what we're talking about. The amplitudes used to be functions of momenta, and now they're a function of lambda and lambda tilde for the external particles. They used to be functions of helicity. Instead of helicity, now we have this smooth Grassmann parameter that labels these Grassmann coherent states. So that's the object we should talk about. There's a final little thing that it's useful to expand this in terms of the number of these Grassmann parameters that are involved. So that's the number of them is 4 times k, where k is this variable here. And physically, these MNK, the K labels, that piece, those superamplitudes contain precisely K negative helicity gluons in the sector that contains only gluons. Okay, so it's K negative helicity gluons together with all of their cousins. It turns out that, this will be important in a bit, it turns out that if you have K equals 0 or 1, no negative helicity or 1 negative helicity gluons, these amplitudes vanish. They only begin to be non-vanishing for the K equals 2. The tree-level version of which we just wrote down a moment ago, that's historically called maximal helicity violating, or MHV amplitude. And then where k equals 3, it's called next maximal helicity violating, NMHV, and so on. So I'll slip into this terminology occasionally. Okay, so we've defined now what we want to compute. Okay, so what we're after a theory that computes this quantity, function of lambda, lambda tilde, this tells you the supersymmetric version of the helicities, and the loop momentum variables. Remember, it's the integrand that we're interested in. So what we'd like is a theory for this object, which is different than the standard one, where we never use the words unitary evolution through spacetime in order to get the answer. And so if we succeed in a satisfactory way, I mean, I just want to emphasize this, the stakes are high. If we do this, then we're figuring out how to get from some other set of principles something which is exactly local and exactly unitary without putting in the words locality or unitary. So in a very specific sense, this would give us a model for both emergent spacetime as well as emergent quantum mechanics. Okay. So now we know what it is that we're trying to compute. Let's start looking at what's some of the actual data. People often complain about theoretical investigations, especially in quantum gravity, there's hardly any data. This business is swimming in data. It's not the sort of data you need telescopes and accelerators for. It's all theoretical data. And the reason is, for 60 years, people have been computing Feynman diagrams. So there's a whole slew of them that are known. We know the answers. Okay? At least for a bunch of them are known. So if you come along saying you have a new whiz-bang way of doing this without putting in space-time, blah, 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 there's no bullshit. Either you can compute those things and many, many others, or you can't. Okay? So we have a huge amount of data that we can compare against. And actually, much of the progress of the past 5 years has been stimulated by the ability to gather vastly more data than we ever could before by finding new computational tools. Okay? So let me show you some of this data. Okay? Now, this is something Michael told you about last week, so I'll just fly through it. But in talking about tree amplitudes, what really revolutionized this business around 5 or 6 years ago was an invention by Freddy and his friends of the BCFW recursion relations, which allowed people to compute for the first time, not stop at 6 particles or 7 particles if your supercomputers lasted that long, but just ways of generating infinite classes of, first of all, writing down the answer and also seeing what they look like for tree amplitudes in Yang-Mills theory and gravity. And the idea is to take the scattering amplitude and deform it in a canonical way into the complex plane. So take 2 of the external particles and shift their momenta to make them complex in a way that conserves momentum, and then look at what that amplitude looks like in the complex plane. And in the complex plane of this deformation, there are poles. Each one of those poles corresponds to a particular physical factorization process with subamplitudes glued together with a propagator, which is developing the pole. And so we know the residues at all of these poles in terms of putting together lower point on-shell tree amplitudes. And providing you understand what's going on at infinity, this allows you to compute higher point tree amplitudes by fusing together lower point tree amplitudes. Okay. So you could finally start computing tree amplitudes in an effective way. So here's an example, and you don't need to look at too many of the details, other than the ones that I'm highlighting. This is the 6 particle amplitude. Now, not for the case Park and Taylor told us the answer for, but for a more generic case where there's 3 negative helicity and 3 positive helicity gluons. I happen to arrange it in this particular way. So it goes plus, minus, plus, minus, plus, plus, minus. Okay. This is the entire answer. Okay. there's three terms. This basic term plus two more that are just related to it by the obvious cycling over by two symmetry of the problem. So those tens of thousands of Feynman diagrams, blah, 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 even for the most complicated case, reduce to three terms. Not one term, but the three terms, as computed by BCFW. But it's more than that it's simple. There's something very striking about each one of these terms, which is that if we look at this term, all these pieces in the denominator, when they go to zero, that's some pole that the answer has. Okay? Every pole of the amplitude should have a physical interpretation. When you have Feynman diagrams, all the poles of the amplitudes, again, have the interpretation of some on-shell, a long-distance physical process happening in space-time. And every one of these poles here is a normal pole. It has such an interpretation. But the answer also has these strange poles. I don't have time to explain why they're strange, but they're not like the normal physical poles. And they vehemently do not have any interpretation in terms of any kind of local process in space-time. So that's already something very striking. This extreme simplicity of the answer is coming because the building blocks clearly are not coming from any sort of local space-time physics. That also tells us something amazing has to happen, because these poles have got to cancel in the sum, because the whole answer just has a local interpretation. But it's built out of building blocks which clearly do not care about locality in space-time. In fact, there are various other things that are not so manifest in the BCFW way of writing the answer, and you can get different answers depending on which particles you choose to do the deformations on, and so on. So, but in this simple case of six particles, there's a single thing that has to be true that makes everything consistent, and the single thing that has to be true is just the following simple, not so simple. Identity. Okay? So this is one way of computing BCFW. This is another way of computing BCFW. They have to give you the same answer. So there are some six-term identity in total. Three terms here, three terms here. There's some six-term identity that must be true. Okay? Well, we know it is true from the underlying quantum field theory. We know it's true. But just staring at this identity directly, without knowing where it came from, it looks miraculous. Just trying to verify it by hand is really, really arduous. Okay? But if this identity is true, it immediately implies the absence of these non-local poles, for example. You can't see it, but the poles that appear on the left and the right-hand sides are actually different. So if this identity is true, those poles can't be part of the final answer. Okay? So BCFW is giving us strange new building blocks that we can build the amplitude out of. They're not local in space-time. They satisfy mysterious identities and relationships between each other. This is the simplest one. If you go to seven particles, there's 12 term identities. Eight particles, there's 20 and 40 term identities. Okay? If you believe that these things are giving you a hint about another place that the amplitudes are coming from, another structure that is computing them, all of these things are giving you hints about what's got to be in that structure. There's got to be some very powerful underlying structure at work that makes these remarkable identities, as well as other things, possible. I'm telling you things that were motivations for going down a certain path 2.5, 3 years ago. Now we sort of understand where all these things are coming from. But we'll see some of that as we proceed. Okay, so BCFW allowed people to gather an enormous amount of data, okay, actually see what was in the structure of the tree amplitudes. And one of the things that was discovered by doing this is, I think, something that clinched the case for many of us that there was something completely spectacular and new and interesting going on, which was the discovery of an infinite number of hidden symmetries in Yang-Mills theory. This is even true, by the way, of the non-supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory. Okay? This is another thing that could have been discovered. There's no way it would have been, but could have been discovered 60 years ago. It happens to have been discovered 3 years ago. So before telling you about the fancy new symmetries, let me tell you about some of the old symmetries. But let's talk about them in a convenient way. So theories of massless particles in any number of dimensions, let's just talk about four dimensions, theories of massless particles enjoy conformal invariance. It's obvious that they enjoy a scale invariance, just because there's no scales in the problem. The conformal part of conformal transformations is more exciting. The exciting part of it are inversions. So it's the fact that if you take x and replace it by x mu and replace it by x mu over x squared, the physics is the same. Inversions are really, they're much more surprising than scale invariants. If you're a grad student, you've seen, or even an undergrad, you've seen inversions at play all the time if you've solved the classic problem of figuring out the electric field outside a grounded conducting sphere. If you solve that problem, you normally put an image charge at a point which is exactly the inversion point from the one on the outside in order to make the potential on the surface a constant. And so this works because electrodynamics has conformal symmetry. Okay? So, so inversions are the exciting part of conformal symmetry. Now, you see, I'm stressing that because you see, inversions are quite nonlinear. They take x and they roughly replace it by 1 over x. And so if we're talking about the standard, if we're talking about the usual space-time way of talking about our theories, classical actions, and so on and so forth, conformal symmetry treats translations, Lorentz transformations, and the conformal transformations on a very different footing. Okay? But there's a much, much nicer and more natural space in which we can talk about this, where the symmetries become much easier to think about, and that's twister space. So I won't have time to go through this in detail, but the basic idea, and which also has, which is very much in tune with the thought of not talking about points in space-time, but only talking about things out infinity, is to not focus on points in space-time, but focus on null rays through space-time. So if you want to write an equation for a null ray in space-time, here's there's a very simple equation. All the solutions x, a dot, that satisfy this equation with two parameters, mu and lambda, you can very easily show all those points lie on a null ray in space-time. And that null ray in space-time is then associated with a point in twister space. The coordinates of that point are mu and lambda. You'll also notice that if I just rescale this whole equation by an overall constant, I don't change what that null ray is. So that means over here, I should think about these four-dimensional vectors modulo and overall rescaling. Okay? So that means a point in twister space is associated with a projective space, a complex projective three-dimensional space. I didn't say it, but everything in this talk is complex. We're not dealing with anything real. We complexify everything in sight. Okay? So now, that's the first basic part of the dictionary. A line in twister space is a line in space-time. Null line in space-time is a point in twister space. Similarly, let's imagine you take two points in twister space. So they define a line in twister space. Well, it's very easy to see that, so this corresponds to a null ray, that corresponds to another null ray, and it's easy to see algebraically that they always intersect at a point. So those null rays always intersect at a point, and that point, there's the simple algebraic solution for what it is. So a line in twister space corresponds to a point in space-time. And something very simple that you can just check from what I've told you is that then conformal transformations in space-time are just simple 4x4 linear transformations of unit determinant on W. Okay? So this is the space in which the action of conformal transformations is as dumb and simple as possible. In particular, the exciting inversions are nothing other than flipping mu tilde and lambda tilde, okay? Which you can very easily see from this equation. If you just divide by x squared, you see you get exactly the same equation back with the role of mu tilde and lambda tilde reversed. So that's one beautiful thing about twister space. All of the geometry associated with the Lorentz transformations, the whole conformal group, just turns into simple projective geometry in twister space. So for example, if you have two points in space-time that are null separated, what that means over here is that this point is associated with the line, the green point is associated with another line. And what could it possibly mean if they're null separated or not? Well, the only possible property they can have is whether they intersect or not. We're not talking about distances or anything like that. So two null separated points correspond to lines that intersect. All right. So that's ordinary conformal symmetry. The exciting thing was the discovery of a new conformal symmetry. And this new conformal symmetry acts in a totally different space. So to see what that space is, let's go back and think about something as simple as momentum conservation. We'll be thinking about momentum conservation a bunch in this talk. But imagine we have these momenta, P1 up to PN. And remember, everything is planar here, so there's a well-defined cyclic ordering to all of the particles. So let's just lay down particle P1, P2, P3, these momenta. Let's just draw them on a piece of paper, on a four-dimensional piece of paper, and just lay them end to end to end to end to end. Okay? The fact that all the momenta add up to zero tells you that what you get from this is a closed polygon. So this is another space. It's not space-time. It is another space. It's another space where the momenta can be thought of as the vertices of a null polygon. Okay? Now, the experimental observation that people made around 5 years ago is that the amplitudes turn out to enjoy conformal invariance in this space, conformal transformations in this space. Again, Lorentz transformations in this space are obvious, are the same as Lorentz transformations in ours, but the full conformal group, inversions in this space, is the symmetry of the theory. Completely astonishing, okay? It's not, no one expected it, and again, if this was a history talk, it's incredible the bizarre, out-of-the-way place this thing was first discovered, okay? But now it plays a very crucial role in the whole story. All right. We now understand why, and we understand very directly how this is true. In fact, term by term, every single one of those building blocks in the BCFW recursion relations are things that are invariant both under conformal transformations as well as under these dual conformal transformations. So that was, in the end, apparently the point in life of these BCFW way of writing the amplitudes. It is the way of writing the amplitudes which manifests both the visible as well as completely invisible symmetry that the scattering amplitudes have, both conformal and dual conformal symmetry. Okay? So we now understand why these non-local poles have to be there. It's because BCFW is serving two masters. It has to manifest the symmetries of two completely different spacetimes, and it can't do that by fully committing to one or the other. It can't be local in one and still symmetrically treat the other. So it's not local. These are the things that make it completely clear that what's going on doesn't prefer either the original spacetime or the new spacetime. Okay. Now, since there's this new conformal symmetry, there is also it's very natural to use a twister space to describe this new conformal invariance, and this is a one of the beautiful inventions of Andrew Hodges from about a year and a half ago. So it's exactly the same idea that we just talked about a second ago. Remember, a point in space-time is a line in twister space. In this case, the point is in this new dual space-time that we're talking about. So this is a piece of the polygon that we just drew a second ago. So that point here corresponds to that line in twister space. This point corresponds to that line in twister space, in this new twister space. And because this point and that point are null separated, this line and that line have to intersect. Okay? So, and this line and the next line have to intersect and so on. So associated with this picture of the polygon in this X space is a picture of one after another intersecting lines in the momentum twister space. And in fact, this gives us a much better set of variables to work with. I can just trade from the standard lambdas and lambda tildes, I can, which define the x's for me, I can trade from them to the momentum twister variables, and there's a very simple algebraic relation between them. You don't need to bother working it out, but it's just the algebraic relation encoded by this picture. And so now we're finally dealing, we're talking about the amplitudes in now the simplest possible way. Okay? We label all the external particles just by momentum twister z. We don't need to worry about momentum conservation. The dual conformal symmetry is manifest, is just built into the formalism. So now the kinematics has been trivialized to the point that idiots like me can work on the problem, okay, and start understanding what's going on. Just a small comment. The fact that the conformal symmetry acts like SL4 makes it extremely easy to write down invariant. Okay, so any invariant now is just you take any four twisters and you just dot them together with an epsilon symbol. Okay, that's what gives you SL4 invariants. Yes. Yes, a polygon, because in general, if you have two points at a generic distance, under conformal transformations, the distance changes. Okay? But if they're light-like separated, if they're originally light-like, they're light-like also after conformal transformations. So that's what's special about these null polygons. And these things, if you're actually working with these things satisfy some important quadratic relations known as the Schouten-Skinner relations. The Skinner here is, by the way, your own Dave Skinner, so you should ask him about this remarkable identity. Okay, so the amplitudes have these two symmetries. There's the conformal symmetry and the dual conformal symmetry. And these are completely different symmetries. They don't remotely commute with each other. And if you actually take them, they generate an infinite dimensional algebra. It's known as a Yangian algebra. And this is an infinite dimensional symmetry that's completely invisible when you write down a Lagrangian. So if you weren't convinced before, if we're talking about things that were, you know, perhaps in the eye of the beholder, do the amplitudes look simple or not? You know, of course, when you go from 100,000 terms to 3 terms, that seems like you're probably missing something. But, you know, this is now a completely invariant statement. The amplitude has properties that are invisible in the Lagrangian. The Lagrangian gives you no reason to suspect that this happens, and yet it's there. Now, as I mentioned right at the start, this is a huge subject, and even though I'm going massively over time, I'm still not covering even the most interesting, even all the interesting things that are going on. So let me just make one comment here about this, because this is related to one of the big strings of activity that are going on here with Pedro and Amit, as well as at the Institute in collaboration with Juan, Davide Gaiotto, Fernando Aldai, and other people around the world. The emergence of this Yangian symmetry is very striking, because this is not the first time this object has made an appearance in physics. Okay? These things show up all the time in two-dimensional physical and mechanical models. The oldest stat-mech model you've all studied in school, the Heisenberg spin chain. The Heisenberg spin chain has a Yangian symmetry. You have a spin of half particles. They have a Hamiltonian, which is SI dot SI plus 1. This problem is famously integrable. And one of the ways that you see it's integrable is there's an infinite number of charges that commute with the Hamiltonian, which aren't local. It's a local Hamiltonian, but the charges are not local. This is the first one of those charges. If you just take the sum over all I less than j of the commutator of SI and SJ, this object commutes with the Hamiltonian. There's an infinite string of the rest of them. Okay? So there's an infinite number of non-local charges that commute with the Hamiltonian. That's a Yangian algebra. Now, of course, we know all sorts of amazing things happen in two dimensions. The world isn't two-dimensional. Okay? So an extremely striking thing that's happened in the last 10 years is the realization that this integral structure is sitting there at the heart of n equals 4 super Yang-mills for a completely different class of observables. Not an observable that's as immediately physically familiar, scattering amplitudes of the gluons, but for the spectrum of the anomalous dimensions of the operators in the theory. And it's incredible that we're seeing the same structure now in the scattering amplitudes. And in particular, one of the most amazing things that happened in this business in the past 5 years is the complete solution for the spectrum of all the anomalous dimensions in n equals 4 super Yang-mills. That crucially made use of all of this integrable structure. Okay? I mean, this goes back to work of Berenstein, Maldacena, Nastasi, through to Beiser, Sadaker, completely capped off by Pedro and his friends a couple of years ago. There is something remarkable that we've already known is going on, not for amplitudes, but for the structure of the anomalous dimensions. There are ways of getting these anomalous dimensions that don't use Feynman diagrams, that are much easier than using Feynman diagrams, that write down some auxiliary two-dimensional system and some remarkable integrable equations associated with it. You solve those integral equations, and tuck, you get out the anomalous dimensions without ever touching a Feynman diagram. So, you know, this isn't something coming in completely whole cloth out of nothing. In fact, we've already seen it in action 5 years ago. What's amazing is that it's continuing. It's continuing to more physical observables. These are observables now where unitarity matters. You know, time matters. Time evolution matters. It's a scattering process. It's not a fundamentally Euclidean question as the spectrum of anomalous dimensions is. Okay? So there's been an enormous amount of work showing how these techniques can be used to studying the scattering amplitudes. First, and somehow most accessibly, starting at strong coupling, when you can relate it to a classical question in ADS space. And then there's been lots of developments after that, trying to make contact with what's going on at weak coupling. I've been focusing and we'll do the, so for the rest of the talk on the weak coupling part of the story. But well, Juan has a very nice analogy for this whole program. It's like building a Panama Canal connecting the ocean of results in field theory to the ocean of results in string theory. And I think for a while, we are saying that we're sort of tunneling towards each other. And I think we can now hear each other's drills, but there's still no direct contact. And I think we won't fully understand what's going on until the connection is made perfect. So that's unfortunately all I'm going to have time to say about that, other than to say this Yangian symmetry is not just some totally weird out of the blue thing. It is made an appearance already in a startling way, and it's sort of even more startling to see it at work in the scattering amplitudes. Okay. All right, so that was the introduction. How am I doing for time? Oh, minus five. Oh, great. All right, great. Okay, great. No, I think I will be able to get through my remaining 30 slides. All right. So I want to tell you about. So that in a sense was all the data, and now I want to start telling you about what a different picture might be for where it's all coming from. And as I mentioned, we don't know the final story yet. So it's very likely that all these things that are being discovered are angles on some more invariant thing. And so, but I'm choosing to give you a particular presentation. The presentation that I'm giving is the one that's deliberately as far removed from standard space-time concept as possible, because that was the whole motivation. I'll say a few more things about some of the related developments. So, as I said, that was all data. Now let's forget about all of it and try to come up with a new way of getting these amplitudes, where you don't put in space-time, blah, blah, blah. Where are we going to start? We're going to start by thinking about momentum conservation all over again. Okay? Now, you might be surprised that anything interesting is going to come out of thinking about momentum conservation. But remember, this is normally what happens when you have dual formulations of a theory. The things that are trivial in the standard formulation will be non-trivial in the new one, and vice versa. It's too much to expect that everything will be trivial in the new one. But you might expect that the things that you take for granted in the standard formulation will be the interesting, juicy bits in the new picture. And why is momentum conservation a good candidate for the thing that should have a new interpretation? It's because why is momentum conservation trivial? It's the one thing which is a manifest consequence of the inside of the spacetime. Momentum conservation is a consequence of translational invariance in the inside of the spacetime. When you do field theory calculations, it comes out explicitly because of that damn d4x integral, e to the I, p1x, p2x, p3x. That d4x in there that gives you momentum conservation. We don't have an x. We don't have an inside of the spacetime. So it stands to reason that momentum conservation is going to be something more interesting if you don't have the luxury of the inside of the spacetime to talk about. So let's actually first talk, just say what momentum conservation is in our language. Remember, we're talking about the momenta, which are, instead of talking about momenta, we're talking about these spin helicity variables, lambda and lambda tilde. And let me think about these in a slightly unusual way. Imagine taking the lambdas for all the particles. This A index runs from 1 to n. It's all the particles. This capital A index is a Lorentz index, so it runs from 1 to 2. So imagine taking, I don't know, the first Lorentz index, all of this set of numbers, lambda 1, 1, up to lambda 1, n, I can group them all into one n-dimensional vector. There's some n-dimensional vector. So let me plot it in an n-dimensional space. N is the number of particles here. Okay? So in an n-dimensional space, I'm going to plot the n-dimensional vector of all of the first components of lambda and the n-dimensional vector of all the second components of lambda. Okay? There's two n-dimensional vectors. Now, it's a little silly to talk about individual Lorentz components, but Lorentz transformations act as SL2, just general linear transformations on these guys. So the thing that's Lorentz invariant is the plane that's spanned by these two vectors. Okay? So that's the invariant data. There's a lambda plane. There's a two-dimensional plane lambda, and there's similarly a two-dimensional plane lambda tilde. So that's the sort of data about the world said in the Lorentz invariant way. It's that there's one plane and there's another plane. And momentum conservation is nothing other than the statement these two planes are orthogonal to each other. Just a sum of lambda. Lambda tilde is equal to zero. So each P is a lambda tilde. The sum over all A, lambda tilde equals zero. if you take any two vectors in one plane, any vector in one plane is orthogonal to a vector in the other plane, so these planes are orthogonal to each other. All right, so of course we're not just going to conserve momentum, but we're going to be inspired by momentum conservation to think about it in a different way. Momentum conservation is a quadratic constraint that relates lambda and lambda tilde, and often in physics it's a good idea to take quadratic constraints and reduce them to pairs of linear constraints. So what we're going to do is introduce an auxiliary third object that we're just making up now. Okay? So there's a third object, which is a general k-dimensional plane in n dimensions. Not one of these, neither lambda nor lambda tilde, some general k-dimensional plane in n dimensions. And what we're going to do is force lambda and lambda tilde not to have a relationship to each other, but each to have some relationship to this plane. So we're going to demand that this plane contains the lambda 2 plane and is orthogonal to the lambda tilde 2 plane. So that's what we're going to, that's what we're going to say. Now, a couple of obvious points. You might complain that this is treating lambda and lambda tilde asymmetrically. In fact, parity exchanges lambda and lambda tilde, so this seems to do brutal violence to parity, but it doesn't, because as you see, this statement is exactly the same as saying that the orthogonal complement of the plane K contains lambda tilde and is orthogonal to lambda. So it's, in fact, a totally parity-invariant statement if you flip from the K-plane to its naturally paired orthogonal complement N minus K-plane. And also note that this is impossible to do if k was 0 or 1. There's no point or line that contains this 2 plane. So it looks like this is no good if k equals 0 or 1. So it's not possible. So it's 0. And you might remember something I mentioned a little while ago about the amplitudes. There's not an accident that I'm labeling these things with the same k, that the supersymmetric amplitudes vanish when k equals 0 or 1. And, well, we're going to relate these things in a second, and this is why. There's a very simple geometric reason why they vanish. So it's actually consistent. That's good. All right, so we can say all this in equations. I'll have to go through this more quickly now. But if you want to talk about a K-plane, well, you should just give K n-dimensional vectors whose span is the K-plane. I can group them into a K-by-n matrix. And if I want to make sure that I'm just talking about the plane, I should make sure that whatever I do is invariant under GLK transformations that acts on the left on this K by N matrix. Okay, but that's a way of talking about the K planes in N dimensions. And the space of K planes in N dimensions is called the Grassmannian GKN. And just from this construction, we can figure out what its dimensionality is. It's K times N minus K, which is very nice. It has a symmetry between exchanging K and N minus K, which is just the natural, obvious symmetry exchanging a plane and its orthogonal complement. Okay? And then you can just say the picture that we wrote, you can just say in equations. I'm not going to go through it, but you write down the delta function that forces this thing to be orthogonal to lambda tilde. You write down something else that forces this plane to contain lambda. And you think you're very happy. But when you look at it, all these darn delta functions spoil the invariance under GLK of this object. It's almost perfectly GLK invariant, but it's not invariant just under rescaling C by an overall constant, just because these delta functions pick up stupid Jacobians when you do that. So you're attempting to make a picture about planes in K-planes in N dimensions, but just this simple picture doesn't quite work. The simplest fix is to add 4 fermionic variables and add an analogous delta function to this one involving these 4 fermionic variables. Famously, supersymmetry cancels Jacobians, and this is a way that leads us to construct n equals 4 super Yang-mills. Okay? So doing this actually makes this maximally supersymmetric. Okay? Now, this object that we wrote down, it looks like this slightly complicated formula, but just this geometry of the plane containing one and being orthogonal to the other one, turns out to look beautifully simple in twister space. Okay? The original twister space, it's just this, nothing other than this object. It simply forces in twister space this K-plane to be orthogonal to the four-plane of all the twisters in twister space. And something this makes completely manifest is that this object is conformally invariant. It's, in fact, super conformally invariant, just because it's so it's written correctly in twister space. Okay, so we're doing something interesting. Starting from momentum conservation, we've been forced to invent supersymmetry, and we're doing something superconformal. We're talking about gluons. We're doing something superconformal. All right, but that was just for one plane. In general, if k is not 0, 1, or 2, for a general k, there's many planes that satisfy this constraint. So we should clearly integrate over all of them. There's no one particular one. How should we integrate over them? Well, I have to integrate over all these k planes, and I have to choose some measure to do the integration. All right, well, there are many measures that you might imagine. They, again, just mathematically have to satisfy the property that are invariant into these GLK transformations. And there's lots of them that you can build. In order for them to simply be invariant under SLK, the only thing you can do is build them out of the K by K minors of this K by N matrix. There's lots of measures you could write, but somehow this is the first measure you might have tried writing, which has this natural cyclic structure that we expect the amplitudes to have. So at the moment, this is aesthetics or simplicity. In a second, we'll see this completely forced on us by other requirements. But even from aesthetics and simplicity, it's the sort of first thing that you might want to write down if you're thinking along these lines. Okay, so that's it. It's just that geometric picture. All we're doing is taking that geometric picture, we're taking it seriously, then we're integrating over all planes with the simplest measure we can imagine. Okay? Well, this is an object that we ran into about a year and a half ago, and you see, it's just an integral. I mean, you wouldn't even, it's not even a theory, it's just an integral. There's no fields, there's nothing that you would recognize as anything normal in here, right? It's just some integral. But remarkably, this integral contains in it all the information about scattering amplitudes in n equals 4 supernormals, not just at tree level, but at all loop orders. The way it contains it is a bit of a song and dance. You have to think about this as a complex contour integral. It's a holomorphic integral, and you compute its residues. And it turns out that the residues of this are in one-to-one correspondence with a particular class of observables associated with the scattering amplitudes known as leading singularities of the scattering amplitudes. It doesn't matter what they are at the moment. It's just something that's there at any loop order. They contain, for example, all the BCFW terms, as well as huge generalizations of them. Okay? But it's something which ordinarily only has a field theory definition with Feynman diagrams and gluing things together and so on. And it's remarkable that it's just computed in this entirely different way from something which makes no mention of the space-time. Or unitarity, or any of those things. But it was only later understood the real purpose in life of this object. The real purpose in life of this object is actually makes this infinite dimensional symmetry completely manifest. And I won't have time to go through this in detail, but just the geometric picture asks you to do something. I'll just say it quickly. You see, we're instructed to integrate over all these planes that contain this one and are orthogonal to that one. Well, that's a little dumb. If they're forced to contain this one, why are we doing, you know, why not just force it manually to contain that one and integrate over all the remaining directions? That's a very natural question. And if you follow your nose, you find that leads you to a rewriting of this original integral in a way that naturally brings out the momentum twister variables and makes the dual conformal invariance manifest. Okay? So just following your nose leads you to this formula. It looks exactly the same. Nothing has changed. The formula is exactly the same. Well, we reduced what we called k before by 2, but that's a detail. The thing which is not a detail is this used to be twister space variables. Now they're momentum twister variables. Okay, but it's identical, exactly the same structure. So that means that this way of writing the answer does make the infinite dimensional symmetry of the theory manifest. And in fact, it has since been realized that this contour integral is the object that generates all of these Yangian invariants. So if you want the building blocks that are invariant under this infinite dimensional symmetry, it's this. And not only does it give you all these invariants, but there's lots of remarkable relationships between the invariants that are a consequence of higher dimensional versions of Cauchy's theorem that also are contained in this object. Okay? But just coming back to some physics, this Grassmannian formulation makes no mention of locality or unitarity, but does something else. It makes all of these symmetries manifest. All right. And I don't think I'll have time to go through this quick example. So that contour integral contains all the information, not about the amplitudes directly, but these quantities called leading singularities of the amplitudes. We just have to go one step further to get the entire amplitude. And the one step further is to realize that these building blocks like to be put together in certain canonical, simple ways. Okay? You can take them and you can fuse them to make a new one. You can take them and you can remove a particle to go from a higher point one to a lower point one. You can take them and merge a particle and make it identical to the one next to it. You can add a particle to one you had before. These are the basic operations that take you from one of these objects to another one of these objects. For example, all the BCFW terms are composed precisely out of operations of this form. So I won't tell you exactly what the combination is, but it's some combination of these operations that we denote by this. So we take this, that kind of object, that kind of object, and there's some canonical way of jamming them together to make a new one that corresponds to BCFW. But there's something else you can do that give you loops. So imagine you started off with a huge number of particles, maybe an infinite number of particles, and you just wanted to ignore a bunch of them. So you just want to focus on a small subset out of this infinite number. Well, in this language, what you should do is just remove one of them, because that's one of the operations. You can just remove one at a time. If you just remove one at a time, nothing interesting happens. You just go down from the higher point tree object, let's say, to the lower point tree object. Nothing interesting happens. But it turns out there's essentially a unique, slightly different thing that you can do, which is if you're removing two particles, let's say you're removing one, and then you're removing the one next to it in the next step. One way you could do it is to remove one of them at a time. The act of removal simply involves integrating over the particles. But another way of doing it involves doing this integral on a slightly different contour of integration. We call it an entangled removal of a pair of particles. And what it literally corresponds to, this is all happening in momentum twister space, is in integrating over these particles, you first, you imagine there's a line between them. So this is what's entangling them. There's a line defined by the two of them. You first integrate over their positions along that common line, and then you integrate over the line itself. That's basically the unique second way you can remove a pair of particles. And it turns out that if we do it the first way, just remove one at a time, it just goes from tree to tree to tree, classical to classical to classical. But this other way of removing them is the origin of quantum loop corrections. So In a specific sense, you're hiding these entangled pairs of entangled particles, and that's where loops come from. And all of this led us to the following formula, generalization of the BCFW recursion relations to all loop order. Okay? So, and this is really the complete definition for what it is, if I tell you more precisely what these things mean. But there is a piece, which is the standard BCFW piece, and there's this new thing that can happen, okay, where you remove these particles in an entangled way. Okay? So this is roughly classical, that's roughly quantum, and that's it. That's an explicit recursive formula. You can feed it to Mathematica, and it gives you the loop integrand to any loop order. So this is a complete definition of the planar theory. Complete definition of the planar theory. The Yangian symmetry is completely manifest, and the word space-time, Lagrangian path integral, gauge symmetry made no appearance. Okay? Out of this definition comes something that's local and unitary, but even despite the fact that neither one of those words made an appearance. Now, remember, there's this beautiful symmetry between the original space-time and the dual space-time. This object, But this way of talking about it isn't making any commitment to either one of the space-time. So it should have a name in both of them. The name it has in the usual space-time is scattering amplitudes. The name it has in the dual space-time is something else. And this is in this dual space-time, remember, there's this natural polygon. And going back to work by Aldai and Maldacena in 2007, people saw that if you thought about this polygon and imagined computing the expectation value of a Wilson loop in a gauge theory, in the gauge theory, where the Wilson loop was given by this particular null political Wilson, by that null polygon, that computed the amplitude. Okay? So this was a piece of this remarkable discovery of dual conformal invariants. Okay? And that was an absolutely fantastic fact. But since its discovery in 2007, people have been attempting to figure out what its generalization was, its proper generalization to talk about all amplitudes and not just the special class of amplitudes that were originally discovered. And in an absolutely beautiful paper, pair of papers, Dave and Lionel Mason, and also our postdoc, Simon Karen Hout, at the Institute, solved this problem just in September. So there's a perfectly beautiful supersymmetric generalization of this Wilson loop. It's very naturally formulated in twistorial language. All the things you would expect since life is good happen. And really perfect symmetry has now been established between the space-time and the dual space-time. So now we have multiple descriptions of what this object is. There's one description which makes reference to neither one of the usual space-time notions, this thing that sits in the middle defined recursively. It's computed by scattering amplitudes in the original spacetime. It's computed by this Wilson loop expectation value in the dual spacetime. And if you want to understand how do you derive this recursive form, you go through one chain of argument from the field theory in the original spacetime. You go through an entire different chain of arguments about this Wilson loop in the dual spacetime that turns out to be related to fancy things like knot polynomials and stuff like that. But there's really perfect symmetry now established between the two sides. All right, I'm coming close to the end. Let me just end by showing you a few things. So I claimed that this is a complete definition of the theory. But it's also a practical one. It's one that you can put on a computer. You don't have to ask the computer to draw lots of diagrams. You just give the computer the formula, and you ask it to crank, and you get the answer. Okay? I just want to show you that when I said before that there's lots of data in this business, and you know when you're making progress, I want to show you some concrete examples of that. And then I'll stop. So this was the state of the art. As of last year, August 2009, for calculating in this maximally supersymmetric theory, calculating the two-loop scattering amplitudes for these maximally helicity violating, the simplest MHV amplitudes. Okay? They're computed at two loops using, this is not Feynman diagrams, mind you. This is the fanciest, best possible cutting-edge ways of doing it without Feynman diagrams, but which were not motivated by the desire to find an underlying theory. Okay. This is what it looks like. So this is trying to compute all two-loop MHV amplitudes. And this is one of eight pages. Okay? So you have that kind of integral. You can't see all of them. Each one of them is weighted by these complicated factors. And there are seven more pages like this where this came from. And in a specific sense, this is half of the answer. There's a second half of the answer that happens to integrate to zero, so people don't care about it. But if you care about the integrand, it's not even the full integrand. It's half of the integrand, okay? So you can see why, even though there was lots of progress in understanding things at one loop, basically extremely little was known at two loops, and there was no reason to suspect any simplicity, okay? This is the present situation as of a month ago, as a consequence of having this all-loop recursion relation. We can write down on one transparency all two-loop MHV amplitudes. I can't explain what these diagrams mean exactly, but they're another way of writing these loop amplitudes that are much more naturally twistorial, that live in momentum twister space. They're very far from the standard ways of writing them, but they're the natural way that the amplitude wants to be written. That entire last transparency plus seven slides plus seven more plus the other half is that top line. That's all two-loop MHV amplitudes. It's that single term summed over many possible permutations and summed over different combinations of these free indices, but there's one object. Okay? These are all two-loop next to MHV amplitudes. Okay? The state-of-the-art as of 4 months ago was computing this after a lot of work for six particles. Okay? There it is for all of them. Fits on a line. This is all three-loop MHV amplitudes. It fits on a line. Okay? Now, I should say that there's a lot more extra magic here, even beyond what I've told you about, because these formulas are even simpler than what's spat out of our recursion formula. Okay? So there's yet more structure here that we don't understand. We've sort of stumbled on the realization that, that there's even simpler ways of packaging these things together. Okay? But there's completely clearly some spectacular simplicity in the structure of the multi-loop amplitudes here, which are completely invisible, totally invisible in the usual way of talking about things. This space-time free philosophy has teeth. It has teeth. It lets you calculate things that you couldn't calculate before. That really just seemed hopeless to calculate before. Now, so far, I've only talked about the integral, the integrand. But you might wonder, you eventually want to do the integrals and get the final answer. Okay? So this slide, there's more of it, is one of 17 pages of slides that look just like that, of an absolutely heroic computation of a six-particle, a finite piece of the six-particle two-loop amplitude. Okay? So this was, again, an absolutely heroic computation that was done about 8 months ago. Right? And it's written in terms of these complicated, complicated or not, they're polylogarithms in general. They're polylogarithms of degree four. So you've maybe heard of the Dye logarithm. You might even have heard of the Four logarithm. These are sort of more complicated generalizations of the Four logarithm, known as Goncharov polylogarithms, after the mathematician Sasha Goncharov. Anyway, so that's the answer. When you do the integrals in the standard way, you take the standard formula in the standard way, you're the greatest set of Russians and others around. This is what you do, okay? And you do it. And this is an absolute tour de force. I mean, incredible. Absolutely incredible competition, and it's correct, by the way. I mean, you know, it passes every possible test. Okay, 20 pages, give or take. Now, independent of the developments that I was telling you about, some of our friends, Mark Spradlin, Nasi Volich, and Christian Vergu, who happened to be at Brown, where Sasha Goncharov, Mr. Polylog, was a professor in the mathematics department, got together with him and tried to see if the answer could really be so very complicated. And amusingly, Goncharov was skeptical that something as horrible as the Goncharov polylog should come out in a nice physics answer. Okay? Anyway, there's a whole theory for how to deal with these polylogs and understand the many, many remarkable identities that are satisfied between them. And if you apply some of this theory to this problem, after some work, you simplify the answer to that. So this is at the level of the answer now, not just at the level of the integrand. We've seen at the level of the integrand there's some incredible magic. Even at the level of the answer itself, the standard way of doing things give you horrendously big Feynman diagrams, A, then you do them and you get even more horrendously big answers. This is the whole answer now. Okay? They're built out of these simple, the simplest possible four log functions. Okay? Now, there's a part of mathematics that's involved in making this happen. There's a part of algebraic geometry that goes back to work of our ideas of Grothendieck from the 60s, known as a theory of motives, that, again, has teeth. It has teeth in controlling the structure of these polylogarithms and makes this dramatic simplification happen. Now, this is one of the things that is in progress right now. We're now trying to understand that's what happens when you take the 20 pages or what you get when you do things in the standard way, evaluated in the standard way. Feynman diagrams, Feynman parameterization, the word Feynman appears as many times as possible. As you see, the goal of this program is to eliminate the word Feynman as much as possible from the computation of the same objects. And so we strongly suspect there's another way of doing these integrals, our integrals, not the standard ones, but these new ones. And there's already been some hints that there is some terrific simplicity just in the structure of these integrals term by term, piece by piece. This is a computation, at least for some kinematic configurations, of an eight-particle version of these integrals by Aldai back in the fall, which is, again, vastly, vastly simpler than you had any right to expect, and vastly simpler than all the intermediate steps when you do it in any standard way. So it's not just there at the level of the integrand. There's one more step, at least one more step in understanding at the level of the final answer. And I really suspect that when we really understand it, we'll see that all of these things are telling us algebraic geometry pictures, are just giving us a picture for each one of these pictures is associated with an algebraic geometric story. And when we know the story is, we'll just write down the answer. There will be no work involved. We won't touch a single integral. That hasn't happened yet, but that's very much in progress. So, finally, going back, there's a reason to strongly suspect we're still missing something. I mean, we're still missing something, not in the details about how to do the integrals, but we're missing something in what exactly it is that we've constructed, what exactly it is that we are talking about. In particular, we have these many definitions for what this object is now. It's a scattering amplitude in space-time. It's a Wilson loop in the dual space-time. Those are both beautiful definitions in terms of standard concepts that we're used to. We also have this explicit recursive definition that makes all the symmetries manifest, whose basic building blocks are much more combinatorial. Okay? We don't yet have a good understanding of what this intermediate, what this recursive definition is really talking about. Okay? In a specific sense, it's like, this is sort of an analogy, but in some special cases we understand that it's actually true. In a specific way, it's as if the amplitudes are like the volume of some polytope in an abstract space. Okay? Imagine the amplitude is the volume of some polytope. If you want to compute it, you'd have to triangulate it in some way. Okay? And there are different ways that you might triangulate it. Like, let's say you want to compute the area of that green region. One way you could do it is think about it at the area of that big triangle minus the area of that little triangle. Another way you might do it is think about the area of that little triangle plus that little triangle. Okay? Those are two different ways of triangulating that one. In a very specific sense, it seems like this recursive BCFW definition that we've given for the all-loop object is like a particular triangulation of something. But we don't know what the something is that we've triangulated. It's like you're handed these different pieces, and you say, that's the answer. But you actually didn't see that they're assembled together to just be this little square. Okay? And actually, if you see that it's a little square, there's another way of computing it, which is to chop it up in a different way. Okay? So that's still something that we are missing. And as I said, our solution, I think, should be thought of as providing one class of triangulations, but we need to much more deeply understand what it is that we're actually triangulating. And in the simplest case of amplitudes, we really understand this. The simplest case of amplitudes, this is something else that was inspired by some earlier work by Hodges, but that we've been pushing more recently. In a very specific sense, you can think about, for example, next to MHV tree amplitudes as the volume of a specific polytope in twister space. And you really see that there's different ways of chopping it up. One way of chopping it up gives you the BCFW formula. But other ways of chopping it up give rise to totally new formulas that have not been written down previously. We have no idea how they generalize. We don't really know what their purpose in life is, unlike our understanding of BCFW. We know the purpose in life of BCFW. But there is something very striking about them, which is that despite all of my jumping up and down and crapping all over locality, every one of these terms is manifestly local. So I think what this means is that in this dual picture that we're looking for, the connection, seeing space-time locality, may well happen even more directly than at least I had ever hoped. It's not going to be in the formalism, but there should be a way of writing it that makes it clear that the process is that there is a local space-time there. So the emergence of space-time will hopefully be understood in a much more vivid way. Okay. So let me end by saying that I think you can summarize a lot of the most exciting things that have happened in the last 20 years by saying that quantum field theory turned out to have incredible, astonishing structures that no one really anticipated in the year 1990. In 1990, I think we thought we understood perturbative quantum field theory very well. And we knew that new things would happen when the couplings got strong, and we didn't know what those new things should be. And then what happened is that people started realizing how to control the strong coupling behavior of quantum field theories, and all sorts of fantastic things happened. There were dualities, there were different ways of talking about the same sorts of physics, there were intrinsically quantum mechanical theories without any well-defined classical limits that they're quantizing, and so on. There's a huge number of remarkable things about quantum field theories that were discovered. But I think it's fair to say they're all discovered in places where the standard way of talking about things didn't exist. So, you know, there be monsters, but the new remarkable things happened where they should have happened, okay, where you didn't know how to control things in any other way. And I think the sort of pinnacle of the most amazing things that quantum field theory can do is they can give you quantum gravity via ADS-CFT. Okay? So, and I think certainly if you had put a gun to my head 5 years ago, one would say that the lesson of ADS-CFT is that the fundamental theory is quantum field theory. It's well-defined. And somehow, it's strong coupling, magically, it produces a theory of quantum gravity in empty de Sitter space. And exactly how that happens, well, who knows exactly, but it's another one of these strong coupling miracles. Okay? I think all of these things that have been going on, again, starting with the remarkable facts about the integrable structures in the spectrum of anomalous dimensions, and now continuing in our understanding of scattering amplitudes, is a realization that it's not that the fundamental thing is quantum field theory and it turns into quantum gravity, but there's some third thing, which is not best described as a quantum field theory. I don't know what it is. I'll call it T, just for theory. I have no idea what it is. But there is something that in some limit is well described by a quantum field theory. In some other limit, it's well described by a string theory. But it's neither one of them. And I think we know this miracle has to happen for a huge number of theories, not just n=4 super EMLs. Okay? We know this is a very tight connection between a huge class of field theories and theories of gravity. Something has got to make that miracle happen. We're starting to see lots and lots of miracles just in equivalent descriptions of what's going on at the weak coupling end, and of course, in this direction. And I think that what this is, what we will see eventually, this has all been telling us, is that it's not that that was not perfectly defined and that was well defined. It's that neither one of them is the best way of talking about things, and there's a third way. There's a third thing out of which both, and it'll be equivalent. I mean, these are all perfect equivalences. But what makes this such a big miracle to try to understand is that the kinds of redundancies we use to describe the physics are radically different on this side. Gauge symmetries on this side. Diffeomorphism redundancies on this side. It's very hard to see how you morph from one to the other without having an intermediate, without having a third description that has neither one of those redundancies, but has its own rules altogether. And we don't know what this is, but we've seen that it has bizarre connections to every other part of the subject, practically. Connections to string theory, integrability, twister theory, as well as all these amazing new mathematical structures that have never had anything to do with physics before, but are popping up left, right, and center. Grassmannian, the theory of polylogs, all my mathematically sophisticated friends tell me that this has to do with motivic Galois theory. I have no idea what any one of these words mean. I know what that word means, and I've heard of this guy, but no one will explain what that is to me. But less jocularly, there's some astonishing mathematical structure here. We're unfortunately or fortunately not in the situation where the mathematicians have all worked it out ahead of time, and we just have to figure out how to apply it. I think they're busy understanding it too, so that means there's going to be an awful lot of fun to be had to sorting this all out. So there's a huge amount left to understand. And I think the biggest problem is what I started complaining about at the beginning of the colloquium. We don't have a one-sentence summary of what's going on yet. We don't have a physical picture behind all of this magic. And because we don't have that, we also don't know what moral lesson we should extract from this very special example of n=4 super EMLs. So, but hopefully this will happen soon. It should happen soon if this program is really to go somewhere. I mean, the overarching goal of this program is what I said, to completely eviscerate locality and unitarity from our language for describing all of standard, good old-fashioned physics. Okay? This is a program that's incredibly constrained by theoretical data. You know when it's going well. You know when you're succeeding. And I suspect if we do succeed, and there are these moral reasons to believe we should succeed, it will tell us something very deep about where space-time and quantum mechanics are coming from, and therefore ultimately how to deform them in situations where they start failing us. So stay tuned, and hopefully we'll have something more coherent to say at a future date. Thanks.
Okay, well, we've gone very slightly over time.
This is, I think, the shortest talk I've given on the subject.
Right?
I should have maybe warned you ahead of time.
I think maybe we should take one question just for form. I'm just looking around to see who has questions. So I'll go with you about that.
This has nothing to do, these exercises at the moment have nothing to do with the real experimental data. Well, they have something to do with real experimental data in the sense that, in particular, this is, if you want the Peskin's colloquium last week, these methods for computing amplitudes, especially at tree level, are equally valid for the non-supersymmetric theory as for the maximally supersymmetric ones. And they're very fast, and they're useful, and they're used by almost all the programs that actually compute backgrounds for the LHC. So regardless of anything new that's found, you have to understand the backgrounds well. And that was the biggest driving force behind the development of the subject for a long time. And it really has the most proletarian possible roots, okay? So it would be wonderful if we can figure out how to apply these same ideas to things which have less supersymmetry and so on and so forth, just to aid in the computation of these backgrounds. That would be great. But it's sort of independent of whether, as physics beyond the standard model, we do or don't have supersymmetry. I mean, these are, N equals 4 superringing mills is a theoretical laboratory. I keep using this language of data because it's very appropriate. It's how you treat it. That you store on your computers all the amplitudes that you know, and you compare conjectures that you have against them, and you try to match them, and you try to see, So there are constant checks on everything you're doing. But it's purely theoretical data. And regardless of whether or not supersymmetry is discovered at the LHC, N equals 4 superyang mills is the harmonic oscillator for quantum field theory. If you think you're going to understand something new about quantum field theory, if it's not working for N equals 4, it's probably not going to work for anything. And conversely, if there is something out there, we should discover it for N equals 4 first. This entire program is, in a sense, decoupled from exactly what comes out of the exploration of the TEV scale. Its whole philosophy is that totally independent of the particular Lagrangian of the world and so on and so forth, there's something in the general structure of quantum field theory that we don't understand, and that's the thing that's worth deeply exploring.
Okay, well, let us thank Nima again for a wonderfully exciting colloquium.
Sorry about that, but that's
I would have been lynched if I stopped.
Okay.